Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com, anywhere in the world. In fact, you can even go back and listen to past programs at KMJ580.com. Click on podcast to access other guests that we've had on this program over the past weeks. Today, we're going to talk about some pretty interesting stuff. We are going to talk to a real pioneer as far as Army engineers who are involved in amphibious landings. You don't hear a lot about that. You hear about the Navy's frogmen, the predecessors to the SEALs, the naked warriors, as they were, who went in the dark of night before amphibious landings happened behind them. You've heard from Navy people and Coast Guard people who helped land troops on the beaches all over the world during World War II. But not too many people know that the Army, and in particular, engineer brigades were actually involved in landing troops and artillery as well around the world during World War II. And today we welcome 91-year-old Russell Elder to the program. Now, Russell, tell me how you ended up doing what you did in World War II. How did you end up in the service? And maybe let's start even before that. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Where were you when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and how did you find out?
Well, I was working for farmhands around the close to home, or sometimes away from home. I had a car when I was 21, and I was gone away from home a lot of the time. That's why I didn't get in the Army earlier. They didn't find me.
Well, normally the prime candidates for piloting landing craft are not farmers in northwest Kansas. I don't think that's their target demographic, but they got a hold of you somehow. Do you remember the first thing you heard about the attacks on Pearl Harbor and how you found out that the United States was at war?
Well, I don't remember that. It's been a long time ago.
It has been, indeed. It's been almost 67 years. We'll celebrate that anniversary this December. Yeah. But Uncle Sam did get a hold of you, and you ended up in the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade?
No.
How did that happen? How did you end up in the service? What do you remember about that?
Well, they just drafted me into the Army. That's all I remember.
Were you excited to go join the fight? You knew that this war was being fought around the world. Was it something that you looked forward to, or you would have preferred to stay home on the farm?
Well, of course, I'd have preferred to stay at home, but I didn't object to going.
Mm-hmm. Was it something that you warmed to pretty quickly, or was it kind of rough? A lot of guys say basic training was rough, and some guys say that was the hardest part of the whole war for them.
I ended up in Camp Robinson, Arkansas, just out of Little Rock, and I found out why they named it Little Rock.
Why is that?
Because I had to dig a foxhole, and you couldn't dig with a shovel. You had to use a pick. The rocks were so close together, you just couldn't shovel it out. Had to pick them loose and then shovel them out.
So that doesn't sound like fun. And then as you started to train, and this was a revolutionary thing at the time. I've read some of the history of your outfit. This was a new idea to have an Army engineer brigade that was supposed to orchestrate amphibious landings. What's the first you heard of that, and did you say, wait a second, I thought I was in the Army engineers here?
I didn't know a thing about it all through basic training. As soon as we got out of basic training, they sent us to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, to train on these little plywood boats. And that's the first we knew where we're going or what we're going to do.
Now, Cape Cod, I imagine, was quite a bit different than northwest Kansas.
Oh, lots different.
And what kinds of things did they have you doing there? I mean, was it something that you picked up pretty quick, or was this a pretty big adjustment for you?
Well, it was a big adjustment, but it didn't take long to learn it.
What were the duties they gave you? What was your role?
Well, first, doing guard duty. A lot of the guys run out in the woods and hid, but the ones that didn't got on. I managed to get on 8 nights in a row, and I got awful tired of that.
Oh, I can imagine. And at this time, this is 1942 now that you're in Cape Cod?
Yeah.
At that time, there's still the specter of the U-boat threat in the Atlantic, right?
How was that?
I said at that point of the war, the U-boats were still active off the Atlantic coast. There was still that fear that the people that they could attack the eastern coast of the United States.
They could have.
And here you are on Cape Cod. Doesn't get a whole lot further east than that.
Well, one night they sent us out to Martha's Vineyard, that island, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like it was a storm going on while we went out there. And we got out there before morning and came back the next night. We went at night instead of daytime, I guess because of afraid of bombers or something. I don't know why, but that's how it worked.
And as happens sometimes in the Army, they like to change their mind about things. Yeah. So here they have you doing these maneuvers. You had maneuvers on Martha's Vineyard. You're training in Cape Cod. In fact, throughout the war, I understand the nickname of the guys in your brigade was the Cape Cod Commandos. Is that right? Even in the Pacific, you are the Cape Cod Commandos? That brings back some emotions for you, I can tell. And that's certainly understandable. But after they trained for all that time in Cape Cod, Uncle Sam said, you know what, change of plans. We're going to send you all the way to the other side of the country, and you're heading out to Fort Ord. Do I have that right? They sent you all the way to California?
Yeah. Well, first they sent us to Carabel, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And we were only there for a couple of weeks, and they changed it and sent us to Fort Ord, California.
And once you got, that's a long train ride to Fort Ord.
Yeah.
You can wave to Kansas on your way by, I suppose.
Well, it's quite a ways away.
Once you get out to Fort Ord, then it kind of intensifies a little bit. They have you doing operations with planes flying over as close to 25, 50 feet to the ground?
Part of the, yeah, but not every day. But we trained on those little LCVs, yeah.
And for those who aren't familiar, those are small landing craft.
Yeah.
And so you're practicing on the beaches of California, but it's probably becoming clear to you that they're expecting you to go into some of these beaches in the Pacific that aren't going to have a welcoming party waiting for you there. Did that hit you at that point, that this is going to be a pretty sticky situation? What goes through your mind at a time like that? I can tell it's kind of hard to talk about right now.
Yep.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll explore more of the experiences of Russell Elder, find out how he earned his Bronze Star, and then was recognized again with an Oak Leaf Cluster. If you win the Bronze Star twice, you get an Oak Leaf Cluster as well, and have the dates, and we're going to hear some of the experiences in 1943 and 1944 that earned him those decorations and what he remembers about his time in the Pacific with the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade during World War II. This is Hometown Heroes. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Playing that tune because our guest again this week is an Army veteran of World War II. You may be a little confused. We were talking about landing craft, putting troops and vehicles on the shores and Pacific Islands. How is he an Army guy? Well, if you aren't familiar with the history of the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade during World War II, in particularly the 532nd was the portion of that 2nd Engineer Special Brigade that Russell Elder belonged to. We talked with him about the training that they had on Cape Cod that earned them the nickname Cape Cod Commandos throughout the rest of the war. In fact, that was a rallying cry in some of the Pacific Islands where they fought later on. Then they shipped them back across to the West Coast for more training at Fort Ord, where they were trained for hand-to-hand combat that they might need when they faced the Japanese. Also trained with planes flying close overhead, trying to simulate the experiences that they would face in the Pacific once they got there. And in September 1943, you were in New Guinea, and It was finally time for combat. The war was a real thing for you. Walk us through what you remember about that, your first taste of combat, and what that was like for you.
Well, we hit Le New Guinea at daybreak in the morning. We went from the south during the night, all night long it took us to get there. And the bombers had come and they'd killed almost all the Japs with bombs, and the rest had run up in the mountain. The mountain was right there back of the camp, and some of them got out there, but they got killed later.
And you, at the time, you were piloting an LCM?
Yeah.
And for
No, 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 LCVP.
Okay, this was before they... Okay, so you're piloting an LCVP, which is a smaller landing craft.
Yeah.
So you're taking Marines to the shore, basically?
Unloading ships and sometimes hauling troops, Australians or... Well, I guess that was mostly all they were. New Zealanders, probably.
So down there in New Guinea, you had Australian forces, New Zealand forces helping you guys out, all part of the Allied effort. And you're coming off a larger ship in this smaller LCVP to deliver things to the shore. This is September 13th, 1943, when that engagement at Lae, New Guinea, began. At what point did it hit you that... This is a little dangerous for me here. This isn't just a walk in the park and an exercise. This is the real deal.
Well, there was no opposition at all. No bullets fired all day long. We worked all day and pretty early in the evening they had us park on a beach, you know, drop our ramps on the beach and put up camp in the jungle, our hammocks. But before we did that, we went swimming.
Was that a choice, a decision to go swimming, or was that an inadvertent twist of fate that allowed you to go swimming?
Well, we had nothing to do. So it was hot, real hot, and we all went swimming. But I had just gotten out, and quite a few of us had gotten out, and some were still in the water. And one of them said, it's nice to see our planes up there. There was four or five planes. And about the time he said that, it just one of them turned, and the bullet just started coming into the water, just like hail, thick. And you should have seen that water pool get dry. I mean, out of there we went. And there were just white streaks at the jungle. About as fast as a horse could run.
Never knew you could run that fast, huh?
Never knew. I haven't done it since.
Was it really your planes? Were they Japanese planes?
Yeah.
They were Japanese or they were American?
Japanese.
They were Japanese. I mean, there are cases where American planes, not knowing who's on the ground, fired in situations like that. So the Japanese see you swimming on...
The bullets, they were wider than what our group was. If that pilot really wanted to kill us, he would have killed his plane a little bit, and he got us all right there before he got started running.
So he was probably up in the sky with a little smirk on his face, saying, I just scared those Americans out of their swimming hole.
I think he was laughing his big head off.
I'm sure you weren't. You weren't laughing at all.
We were terribly scared.
Well, I can imagine, too, the thought of, well, my folks back home are going to read that I was killed taking a swim on New Guinea. That's not going to go over very well. Not the heroic outcome that I'm sure you envision. But you survived that. They didn't get you. They just scared you.
He could have tilted his plane just a little bit, and it would have just got us all. But he left it going straight down too much, and he probably had to level off and to keep him running into the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And he quit shooting when he did that, or else he'd have got us.
Well, I'm glad he quit. I'm glad he didn't get you.
I wouldn't be here if he hadn't quit. I don't think he wanted to kill us.
Right.
Or else he was an inexperienced pilot that didn't know how to operate very good. One or the other.
Either way, you're not complaining, and I'm not either.
I'd like to talk to that pilot.
Shake his hand? I don't blame you. So there's a scare. But now you get back to your encampment on the beach. Did you sleep on the beach that night, or were you back at the ship on the beach?
We was on the beach in a hammock.
Did you sleep well that night?
Well, I guess so, but it was a short night because when they leveled off, they dropped a bomb over to the left of us, and it made it like an ocean wave came in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like an ocean wave. It just came on, not... didn't keep it up.
I could see how that might wake you up.
And well, we were that's just after while we were just in the jungle.
Okay.
One bomb that hit over to the left had covered up some fellas in foxholes. It killed one guy, but it's a wonder it didn't get more. After the planes were gone, we went and got our clothes on and went over to get something to eat. Well, the Australians, they were acting crazy. They were celebrating, and they were just laughing, hollering, yelling around. And we couldn't figure what was wrong. Well, there had been a big pile of cans of what they call bully beef. It was big cans about this long, like sardine cans,
mm-hmm.
and a big stack of them that was out away from the jungle in a clearing, and the bomb hit it, and them things went out of there like bullets. All of that stuff disappeared, and the Aussies were just celebrating because they were so tired of eating that diet, and it only lasted a day or two. Because we ran out of food.
So they weren't celebrating then?
No. Then they were glad to have what little was left in the kitchen.
Well, I was going to say, I know the former prisoners of war that I've talked to, either guys that were on the Bataan Death March or guys who spent time in some of the stalags in Europe, they were thankful if they ever found a can of bully beef. They wouldn't have been celebrating. It sounds like pretty soon you guys realize, well, we miss that bully beef now. Starting to lose a little weight here.
Well, I didn't miss it. I really liked it, but we had to eat it on what they called a shingle.
Yep, yep. I think a lot of our listeners have probably heard the euphemism there. Yep.
But you couldn't bite that stuff until it was fried in oil, you know, to soften it up a little. Well, after it was softened up, it wasn't too bad, but you couldn't bite it. It was like eating a piece of wood. That's why they call it a shingle.
It's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah.
You like it a lot more when you're hungry.
You bet.
And when you've got a full stomach.
Well, I came in late from work a day or so after that, and they said that the rest of them had ate, and there was nothing left. But they did look around, and they found a can of pork. And they gave that to me, that's all. That's all they had. And so I took it and I ate it and got in my hammock and hardly got in until I got so sick. I got up and I was heaving it up, you know, making quite a noise. And I could see out towards the ocean underneath the brush. And there was big hats and, you know, Australian... troops that come along patrolling the beach, and I knew if I didn't do something, they would shoot me. They just loved to kill Japs.
So they would have mistaken you for a Japanese soldier since you were out wandering in the middle of the night.
They heard me. They thought it was a sick Jap, and I knew what they'd do. They'd start shooting if I didn't get out of there right quick, so I went over to where the opening was to get out. And I hollered at him, don't shoot because I'm coming out. And I told him I was an American soldier. And I came out with my hands up. Well, if I hadn't had my hands up, I would have been dead. I know. Each one of them had a gun, and he was just ready to blast me. And if I'd made a move of any kind, I'd have been dead instantly. And I told them who I was, and they didn't believe me. They thought I was, you know, the Japs played tricks like that. And they'd come out at night and holler, "Hey, Joe, where you at?" Mm-hmm. Well, if the fellows would answer, they'd go right over and kill them. But we never, we wouldn't answer them, and then they'd go away. And they thought I was one of them kind of Japs that was playing a trick on them, I guess.
Well, but, I'm glad they finally believed you.
Finally, one of them said, "Well, take me to your leader." I said, "Okay." And so we went in, and they talked to the officers in the camp back farther in the jungle than where we were, and they decided to tell the truth.
Sounds like a pretty eventful first couple of days for you there in Lae, yeah, New Guinea. And I also understand that that period, September 13th through 15th, your actions earned you a Bronze Star. So we're going to talk about that as soon as we take this commercial break and come back. We'll hear about how that Bronze Star came to be in the possession of Russell Elder, our guest today on Hometown Heroes, here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at KMJ580.com.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me.
Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
Don't go walking down Lover's Lane.
I know that brings back a lot of memories for a lot of you. Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, and that, of course, was the orchestra of the late, great Glenn Miller. You know the story behind his disappearance over the English Channel in World War II. His music lives on. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Russell Elder wasn't sitting under an apple tree, but he learned you're not supposed to swim in a New Guinea lagoon either if you don't want to get shot at by Japanese fighter planes. Thankfully, they didn't get him. After that brief swim, he was able to get his clothing back and get back to work as part of the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade serving in New Guinea at that time. He would spend plenty of time in the Philippines as well before the war was over. You heard him talk about piloting that LCVP. This is early on in the war, still September 1943. So things in the Pacific were just getting going as far as Americans were concerned. This is long before Iwo Jima or Okinawa or any of those famous battles that we hear so much about. And actually, when you think about it, New Guinea is an often overlooked area of World War II. People probably don't talk about what happened there enough. But I know the memories are still sharp in your mind. And I have here, I've seen the record. You were awarded a Bronze Star for your actions in September of 1943. So what did you do to deserve the Bronze Star? Tell us about that.
Nothing more than everybody else. We just worked every night. We hauled from the ship. We unloaded the ships, and we made two trips to far shore, unloaded, came back and got loaded again, and then got back to the camp at daylight. That's the way it went on for about a month. And then that that New Zealand second lieutenant wanted to ride back with me, and I started back. I knew the way to get back, but...
Yeah, it sounds like you'd made plenty of trips by this time.
Well, I never had any trouble. I went by compass. Mm-hmm. Couldn't see anything. Too dark. And he came up and looked at my compass, and he said, "You're on the wrong thing," and he put me off on a different thing, and I said, "No, we'll hit rocks." And he just screamed in my ears till I started out. And when he got away, I turned, but he realized I'd turned. He came back, and oh, but he gave me the awfulest scolding. And
I imagine you can still hear his New Zealand accent yelling at you to this day, huh?
Oh, yeah, silly fella. If I hadn't known the rules of the sea, I was... Captain, he had no right to be there, but I didn't know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd known, I'd have thrown him overboard with an anchor tied on him. I mean it.
Well, I could tell. Well, and I think our listeners will understand why you say that once you finish telling them what happened.
Well, we hit the rocks.
Just like you told them you would.
And it bent the propeller so bad that it shook the boat terrible. I knew it would tear the propeller and the shaft and everything going to be torn off, and the boat would leak. And we'd probably sink out there, and we couldn't go anywhere without paddling with our hands. And
so how'd you get back to the ship?
I just let it idle real slow, and the prop was enough of it to would push the boat slow. And we got back to camp. It was afternoon. Instead of daylight, it was afternoon. And you know, that fella never even talked to me after that.
Yeah, I'm sure you didn't need to say anything to him. He knew exactly what you were thinking. Yeah. And he was glad you hadn't had an anchor handy to throw him overboard with.
But I seen something that made me happy that happened to him. I was on another boat after my boat was wrecked. They put me on as an extra on another LTM. And they sent us out at night, and it was terrible dark. You know, you can't see anything. You can't see the mountains. Some nights you can, but usually it's just black. And they had a fellow on each side of the ramp up on the front end to warn if there was anything close. They could see better than from back where the driver was. And
mm-hmm.
So this knothead with the New Zealander, he had binoculars, and he was standing up on a box about 2 feet high. He was looking around. I don't know if he'd see anything, but the guys yelled, and the coxswain there, he just threw it in reverse and stopped. And he went right on his belly on that hard floor. I was hoping it killed him, but it didn't.
I was waiting for you to say they flipped him right over the edge and out into the drink, but I guess landing in the boat is better.
I would like to see him go over the edge, yeah.
No hard feelings or anything.
Oh, of course not.
But so you had been given the Bronze Star for being able to make it back after the ship was so badly damaged?
Just, a lot of us got Bronze Stars for the good work we'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Working all night and no trouble till that happened.
Was there ever a point where you're on that damaged ship and not knowing if you're going to make it back, that you sat there and thought, I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know if we're going to make it.
Oh, you mean after I hit the rocks?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I just had confidence we'd get there. And we did, but it was real late.
It took a while.
Well, the Japs could have seen us for hours there if they'd have came around on planes, but they didn't happen to come around.
That would have, given new meaning to the term flying, sitting duck.
Yeah.
And speaking of ducks, and I kind of glossed over this earlier, I understand, and a lot of people, if they've been to some of the tourist places around the country, I know in Honolulu they have some, in Boston and Washington, D.C., they do these duck tours with the big amphibious vehicles. I understand that your brigade was the very first military unit in the United States to operate those duck vehicles. Was that something where the first time you saw it, you said, what in the world is that?
Well, we saw them on land.
Mm-hmm.
They were just trucks that had been made in with propeller on the back end and tracks on the wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't do any good in the water, I guess, but they could go on the land or in the water, either one. That's why they made them that way.
But you hadn't seen any of those in Kansas, I imagine.
Oh, of course not. Or anywhere in the United States. I hadn't seen them.
No, your unit was a pioneer when it comes to those. So there is a lot of war left at this point. We're just wrapping up September of 1943 there in New Guinea, but you had a lot of things left to do. What do you remember next that really stands out after New Guinea? Maybe there's still something else in New Guinea that really jars your memory, but I imagine for all that time.
The Japs were all finally got all scared away or killed. I remember coming back from a point way out about, oh, it must have been 50 miles or more, that they had sent me with something or other. And I was coming back, and there was a terrible smell coming out from the camp when I got within a mile of it, I guess. They had dug a big trench with bulldozers, and they were putting all those dead Japs in there. Mm. They just piled them in there and covered them up. But they were putting them in when I came along. That was why they smelled so terrible.
Oh, I can imagine. And I know that there were plenty of American troops who would shed their blood on those islands, too.
Yeah.
And a lot of them met with similar burials. And that's just one of the harsh realities of World War II. 400,000 Americans died and millions died worldwide during that time. And
yeah.
I imagine there was a time or two where you wondered if you were going to be added to that total, if you were going to be one of the guys who didn't come home.
I wondered that when them bullets were coming down in the water, too.
I could imagine so.
Well, we were never so scared before in our life.
Do you ever think back and marvel at the fact that you did come home? Do you think you beat some odds in surviving everything that you did?
Well, I think that pilot in that plane didn't want to kill us.
But I'm sure that wasn't the only time that things could have gone sour on you.
Oh, I don't know.
No, and there was another Bronze Star or an oak leaf cluster supplementing that Bronze Star that would come at Leyte in the Philippines. A lot of people are familiar with Leyte, the connection with General MacArthur and the things that happened there as well. And I'll tell you what, we're going to catch our final commercial break here. Then when we come back, we'll talk about that and the rest of Russell Elder's service during World War II. He's from the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade, a pioneering outfit that participated in the Pacific during World War II. And we'll be right back as Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Praise the Lord to pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord to pass the ammunition. Praise the Lord to pass the ammunition and we'll all stay free. Praise the Lord and swing into position.
I forgot that politician line was in this song, Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. I guess that's appropriate as we approach November 4th here in the United States. Might not even be having elections like this if not for the service of the more than 16 million Americans who wore a uniform for Uncle Sam during World War II. One of those is our guest today, Russell Elder. You've heard him talk about the time he spent piloting landing craft in the Pacific, not as a member of the Navy or the Coast Guard, but the good old U.S. Army, part of the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade. And he has more to tell us now. There's a lighthearted story that I hope we'll have time to share before we're done, but another moment that you can look back on and say, yeah, praise the Lord, pass the ammunition, and thank the Lord that I'm still here, because you had an encounter in the jungles of New Guinea with a Japanese soldier that very easily could have killed you, you could have killed him, but you both walked out of there. Let's talk about that. What do you remember about that encounter?
Well, I was walking through the jungle, and I happened to see him. He was about 20 feet, I guess, from me, and he sat there looking at me, and I seen he wasn't gonna, he didn't move to hurt me anyway, and I didn't feel like killing him for that. And besides, if I had pointed my gun at him, he might have had one in his hand that I didn't see, mm-hmm. and he'd have gotten me. But he acted more like a friend than an enemy, and I just kind of waved at him and walked off.
You guys actually smiled at each other and waved, like two guys seeing each other on the street today. Hard to imagine that in the middle of a war, especially now, one as intense as that.
Some of them Japs were friendly. I hauled a whole bunch of, where we'd been hauling the stuff at night to that camp, there was a Japanese camp right beside the Australian camp, and neither one knew the other one was there.
That's hard to believe, isn't it?
The Japs had been parachuted in. I mean, the Australians had come in parachutes, probably at night, and come up by the beach and didn't know that they were right close to a Japanese place. Well, when we came in with the boats, I hauled the prisoner away, and he told me what happened. He said when we came in with them boats, he said they thought it was tanks roaring around, and they all ran out in the jungle and hid. And he was laughing about it, making fun of what dummies they were, you know. They all ran away and left the guns and everything, and the Australians then went in and took all their stuff, and when they came back, they took them prisoners. they had nothing to fight with, and he was laughing about it.
What? I could see where he would.
And, you know, some of them were decent fellows.
Well, it sounds like it.
I think that one in the pilot in that plane was one of that kind of fellows that didn't really want to kill us.
Well, I tell you, you talk to ace fighter pilots, whether they served in Europe flying against the Germans or in the Pacific against the Japanese, they have so much respect for the pilots that they went head-to-head with, and a lot of them are friends to this day, especially the aces. They've found each other out. They've made those connections, and it is certainly a lot neater now to look back and see how healing has happened across the world and throughout those cultures. And even here in the San Joaquin Valley, too, with how Japanese Americans were treated here while you were fighting the Japanese overseas. And there's some great efforts underway that we'll discuss in the coming weeks to memorialize the sufferings of Japanese Americans here in the Central Valley during World War II.
Yeah, I don't know why they jailed them and treated them so bad.
No, and it's really inexcusable in hindsight. Yeah, and the U.S. government has made some reparations, and here in the San Joaquin Valley especially, there is a great history, and they're making great strides. There's going to be a memorial that'll be dedicated in February for the Pinedale Assembly Center, where a lot of the Japanese Americans were forced to go and then sent to relocation camps across the western U.S. And we'll have several guests on the program as that approaches who are relevant to that. We continue now with Russell Elder, and you didn't get to stay in New Guinea forever. As much as you would have liked to go swimming some more and get shot at some more in your skivvies, they sent you to the Philippines. And about a year after all this that we discussed with the Bronze Star, the first time you were worthy of a Bronze Star, October the 20th, 1944, in Leyte, in the Philippines, you were awarded similarly again. What did you do that time? And I don't want to hear that you just did what everyone else did. I know that you did, and everyone's a hero, and anyone who wore the uniform was.
Well,
but tell me what
you did. I didn't think it was anything special, but I had an officer and a few soldiers, Australian soldiers, along, but they had loaded my boat with a big, heavy-loaded truck backed in with a two-wheel trailer behind it.
So this is one of the bigger LCMs now that you're piloting?
Yeah, it was a 56-footer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize, well, it happened so quick. The front of the boat was down row, and instead of going in 4 feet of water like we could empty, it was in about 6 feet of water, and it hit the bottom, and I couldn't go. I dropped the ramp, and that truck roared out of there real fast, and I never thought what was going to happen, but it was so quick, didn't have time to think of anything, really. As soon as the ramp went down, he just shot out of there like within a race. And when the trailer was on the ramp, when the boat just roared up, came up out of the water real fast, and it snapped the cable, so we couldn't get the ramp up.
Mm-hmm.
And I hollered my engineer, and he came and took the wheel, and I went down in the engine room, and I don't know It didn't break the cable right off, like cut, but it let strings come out, you know.
It was fraying the cable so it wouldn't hold the ramp up anymore.
Yeah. Couldn't raise it.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally got enough slack to wrap that one of them pieces that stuck out a ways around and put the cable over it. So, and then I told him to raise it. He started it up, and I came out of there fast, and he ran out of the engine, the shelter there around the wheel, and I went and got a hold of it and put one motor in reverse and the other in forward, and it just turned like that, and we got out of there. Just as we were leaving, a Japanese bullet, a big shell, hit a big palm tree that broke it off, and it fell right down where we'd been at. If we hadn't have turned and got out of there, we'd have got hit, maybe killed, or anyway, we could have never got away.
You would have really been stuck then. You're almost stuck before.
And the officer on there, he gave us all a Bronze Star medal.
Now tell me something. You just mentioned, and I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and follow along here, and you say, well, I put one engine in reverse and the other one in forward, and we shot out of there. You made it sound pretty simple. But is that something that you'd actually been taught, or is that something that you just thought of in the instant?
Oh, I knew all about that.
You'd been taught to do that?
I wasn't taught to do anything. I learned it all myself.
It was kind of like just intuition, like something you would have done with a tractor back home on the farm in Kansas if you had to?
I knew what would happen.
Yeah.
I knew what it would do.
Yeah.
Put one in reverse, way it just goes like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just shot around there and shoved the other handle forward, and away we went with both motors going full blast away from there. And just as that thing hit the water.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of guys on that ship that were glad that you thought of that in that instant, that
well,
you tried
of course
to.
They were.
You that saved their lives.
That officer's the one that gave me that medal, I'm sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
To save his life as well as mine.
Certainly well deserved.
Well, we might have not got killed, but if it had hit on the boat at all, we couldn't have got away. We couldn't have moved.
Yeah, so if the tree didn't kill you, the Japanese might have killed you after the tree got you stuck.
Oh, yeah.
We've just got a couple minutes left in the program here. I do want to fast forward you. That's October of 44, so it was still another 10 months until the war ended in August of 1945. Where were you when you heard it's all over? You get to go home.
And I forgot the name of the island. They called me out one day and hooked me on behind a 300-foot LCT, a big tanker.
Mm-hmm.
With
right.
All big tanks and all kind of stuff on a long cable in Mindoro.
Mindoro, mm-hmm.
Hauled us away to Mindoro. And when we got within a mile or so of the beach, they cut us loose. They went on in, and I started the engine, and here coming Zero toward us. And my engineer and seaman were on the back where the machine guns were, and they got ready to shoot, and they started shooting, and, well, the plane didn't get hit till it got square behind us, and then they shot it down.
Well, the war was supposed to be over at this point?
Oh, no.
Oh, this is just before it. Okay. I got a little confused there with you. Well, we're just about out of time here. I wanted to have you share the story. I don't think we're going to have time for the whole thing, so I'll try to summarize it quickly. There's a young man in boot camp who didn't have very good personal hygiene, and in order to get the message across, some of your buddies decided they'd teach him a lesson, and what did they use to wash him?
Brushes, these stiff brushes, and
So they gave him a bath where instead of a washcloth or a bar of soap, they had a wire-like brush.
They used out brushes on him.
And did he ever fail to shower again?
No, he was always the first one there.
Well, I'm glad they never had to do that to you. And I'm very glad that you had time to come in and sit with us today and share some of your memories from your time in the service during World War II. Thank you very much for serving our country, for talking about it, and congratulations on 91 years. And I look forward to hearing about the century mark for you in about 9 years. Sound like a plan?
Yeah.
All right. Russell Elder was our guest today here on Hometown Heroes. We'll be back with another edition next week on News Talk 580 KMJ.